The regular reports on global warming do not inspire confidence that we're getting the situation under control or even beginning to. The various multinational agreements on addressing climate change set some targets, among them keeping the rise in temperatures on the face of the Earth within a small range, like under 2 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. But a new study in the journal Nature Climate Change brings out statistical models that show those targets will be very, very hard to hit. Adrian Raftery is the lead author of the study, a professor of statistics and sociology at the University of Washington, one of five people who worked on the project, and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Raftery, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So for a starting point, that 2 degrees Celsius figure that seems to be used a lot, why is that deemed so important?
Well, this has been a target for a long time, partly, I think, because there's the idea that it's a kind of tipping point beyond which climate change might become self-reinforcing and run away.
Oh, so the idea being that if we can keep it at 2 degrees Celsius, we might keep it from becoming like the proverbial snowball gathering momentum downhill?
Exactly. I think that's really the idea.
So, in fact, the Paris Climate Accord set an even lower target, is that right?
Yes, the Paris Climate Accord set a target of 1.5 degrees Celsius. And our study, unfortunately, seems to suggest that both of these targets, that the 1.5 degrees is really out of range by the end of the century, and the 2-degree target for the end of the century was just possible but unlikely to be reached.
And in fact, the title of the publication is Less Than 2 Degrees Celsius Warming by 2100, Unlikely. That's in the July 31st issue of Nature Climate Change. There are various scenarios geared directly into the temperature figure. Are there rise in sea level or things that would happen more if the rise in temperatures were greater than 2 degrees Celsius?
Yes. I think, broadly speaking, the greater the rise in temperature, the more severe the consequences. And the consequences, there's a range of consequences which have been delineated by climate scientists, and they include severe weather events like heat waves and storms of various kinds, and also sea level rise and what comes with that, particularly flooding and maybe the obliteration of small island nations.
I'm intrigued by the fact that the team of people who took this on are to a person. And let me give the other names. So it's you, Adrian Raftery, Alex Zimmer, Dargan Frierson, Richard Starts, and Perrin Liu. So you're all statisticians, is that right?
Actually, no. So there are three faculty leaders of the project. So there's myself, and I'm a statistician who also works on demography, on population issues, which is a big input to this work. Richard Starts is at University of California, Santa Barbara, and he's an economist. And Dargan Frierson is a colleague of mine at University of Washington, and he's a climate scientist. So we're actually an interdisciplinary team who works on this. And the reason, there's various both economics, population, and climate science go into this, and it's all tied together by statistical modeling.
So what got the project started? When did you guys begin to think that maybe we were being a little optimistic in thinking about 2 degrees Celsius being attainable by the end of the century?
Well, really, it came about, I had been working on population projections with the United Nations, better ways of forecasting the future population. And this was so some work came out on that, and this was a very important input to climate change projections. So the idea was to look and see what the implications of better population forecasts would be for climate change projections. And so we got together as a team with starting off with that, and pooled our expertise. And so the way our approach was to take, we assembled data on economics, so GDP, population, and carbon emissions over the last 50 to 60 years from 150 countries that account for 99% of the world's population. And then we built a joint statistical model using these data and projected forward into the future.
We are talking again with Adrian Raftery, the professor of statistics and sociology at the University of Washington. He is one of the lead author of a study published in Nature Climate Change indicating that trying to keep the Earth's temperature under a rise of 2 degrees Celsius by 2100 is unlikely. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Before we get too far away from the population projections, I mean, what do you see coming there? Because there's still some disagreement about whether we're going to get to a point and level off or whether we're going to continue to climb. And where do you see the population of the Earth hitting over the course of this century?
Well, our work suggests that it will hit now we're at just over 7 billion, and it seems likely that we will hit somewhere around 11.5 billion by the end of the century. So an overall global increase of about 4 billion. We found, however, that this was not a big factor in climate change, and the reason, or in carbon emissions, at least for the rest of this century. And the reason is that of this projected increase of 4 billion to the people to the end of the century, 3 billion or three quarters of the increase will likely be in sub-Saharan Africa. And their carbon emissions and economic production are so low right now that even with the projected population increase and economic growth, they would still be accounting for a fairly small fraction of the world's carbon emissions. So it seemed like, actually to my surprise, that for this century, population growth is not the major driving force of carbon emissions and hence of climate change.
That's really interesting because there are some people who seem fond of talking about the fact that they think the Earth's population will level off at about 9 billion. You see it getting a whole lot larger, but the impact being somewhat muted because of the fact that there won't be a lot of production of the things that cause global warming out of those people, which brings us, I guess, to the basis of something called the Kaya identity, which is sort of this ongoing formula used to figure out what might happen to the planet. What are you mentioned them briefly, but can you expand a little more on what the factors are?
Sure. The Kaya identity basically breaks down future carbon emissions and actually beyond that impact on climate into three factors. And one of them is population. The second is GDP per capita, so economic production or well-being per capita. And the third one is what's called carbon intensity, which is the amount of carbon emissions needed to produce a given unit of economic production, like $10,000 of economic production. So essentially, future carbon emissions can be calculated by multiplying these three things together.
Now, the carbon intensity, then, would seem to be the key figure. So what does that mean, first of all?
Well, that means how much carbon do you need to produce a given amount, say, $10,000 of GDP. So that's and we call it intensity because it's the amount you need. And what we found is something, I think, that hadn't been highlighted in previous studies and was interesting, which is that past a certain point, it seems that almost all countries have had declining carbon intensity, which means improving energy intensity, improving carbon efficiency. So the amount of carbon needed to produce a given amount of GDP has been going down steadily in most countries over the past 50 or 60 years.
All right. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the idea. So basically, if GDP continues to expand at certain rates, at X level of carbon intensity, that you're going to get a good multiplier. But if the carbon intensity can be lowered per unit of GDP, then you actually end up with less of a carbon footprint.
That's right. And we've been finding that GDP has been increasing steadily over time. And the carbon intensity has been going down steadily over time. And so these have been almost canceling out. The rates are very similar. So we have, the good news that carbon efficiency has been improving. But then, if you like, from the climate point of view, the bad news that economic production has been increasing, although that's, of course, good news for individual people. So that we're, in a sense, running quite fast to stay in the same place. And our projections do take account of and assume that the improvements in carbon efficiency will continue. And the improvements in carbon efficiency, they're due both to technical and technological improvements, and also to regulation and legislation, for example, such as the kind of regulations that were put in place as part of the Kyoto Agreement, which is the agreement that regulated climate change from the 1990s until recently.
We're talking to Adrian Raftery, a professor of statistics and sociology at the University of Washington, one of five authors of a study recently published in Nature Climate Change that indicates that less than 2 degrees Celsius warming by the year 2100 is unlikely because it's just a hard target to hit, and it's because we're still doing a lot of things the same way. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the issues here, 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. We got a call right off the bat, Adrian, from a Jimmy in Medford who says, if we reach this today, it needs 50 years to be effective. Is he on target there?
Well, they're actually in the same issue of the journal Nature Climate Change that our paper was published in. Another paper was published which addressed the same kind of concerns, but in a different way. And what they asked the question, you know, if we stopped carbon emissions right now, what would happen in the future? And they came up with the conclusion that there would be probably at least 1.3 degrees. So, you know, even if we stop all carbon emission, which means, you know, nobody flies anymore, nobody drives anymore, it's something that's, you know, it's just not in the realm of possibility. We're still very close to, or maybe at that 1.5 degrees increase. And that is very much in agreement with our conclusion that, you know, 1.5 degrees is going to be very, very difficult to achieve, or essentially impossible.
Impossible. And then how difficult to get to keep it under 2 degrees by the year 2100?
Well, our conclusion was the probability is about 5%. So one chance in 20, which, you know, we don't take the exact number 5%, you know, all that seriously, but it does suggest that it's, you know, just possible if we pulled out all the stops, but would be very difficult to achieve.
So on the other hand, then a 95% chance that we'll go above 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100 in rise.
Exactly.
Wow. And what's the midpoint of the range, though? What is the range and what's the midpoint?
So the range is from 2 degrees to 4.9 degrees, and the midpoint of the range is 3.2 degrees, so that's our median. It's also the main previous projections were produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they didn't produce a, you know, statistically based forecast. What they did was they produced scenarios illustrating things that might happen in the future, and they produced four scenarios. And we actually found their most optimistic scenario is very unlikely, and our median of 3.2, our midpoint degrees, is kind of in line with their two middle scenarios. So we're broadly, you know, in agreement with what they say, but we've tried to, you know, put flesh out what the likely range is and how likely various outcomes are.
My in-the-brain conversion chart is still a little slow. 3.2 Celsius is about how much Fahrenheit?
So that's just, I believe, just under 6 degrees Fahrenheit.
All right. So that is it's significant when that continues around the world. Let's take some calls here. We have Charlie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about global warming and the speed of it with Dr. Adrian Raftery.
Yes, good morning. And I'd like to talk about the speed at which economic decline occurs with cooling periods. And that, for instance, a study out of the Chinese Academy of Sciences looked at the last 2,000 years in China of proxies, tree rings, lake sediments, ice cores, stalagmites, usual things. And what they, just a quick summary, what they found, and their analysis showed that it matched up with the records in Europe, the medieval climate anomaly, the Little Ice Age, all the rest of it. The thing that I find most interesting is that historically, cold periods were negative and warm periods are positive. For example, 25 of the 31 most prosperous periods in Imperial China during the last 2,000 years occurred during periods of warmth and warming. A cooling trend were correlated with periods of social vulnerability and economic decline. So, I mean, this mass hysteria that's being generated by a very mild rise, which may or may not be anthropogenic. There are many other factors: ocean warming due to undersea volcanoes, solar. The whole solar cycle that goes on, the input to the Earth from solar radiation and its variability. Most stars tend to be of a variable nature.
So, Charlie, if we extrapolate this out, then does even greater heat indicate greater economic prosperity?
That seems to be what came out of the Chinese study when they looked at all the various dynasties, the periods that were cold, the periods that were warm, for the last 2,000 years, with a 95% confidence level, without getting into all the statistical details, it appears, and if you look past, even in European history, the decline of the Roman Empire and the anarchy that followed came in a cold period, whereas the great rise of these civilizations occurred during warm periods.
So warming is a good thing, you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that extracting the man-made influences from the natural cycles is difficult at best, I think, to clearly quantify. Secondly, the hysteria being generated on the so-called, first of all, we keep referring to climate change. Well, the climate's always changing. I mean, look at drive through southeastern Oregon. There are wave-cut terraces from Pleistocene lakes 35 and 40 feet above the present ground surface.
Okay, let's
we've been drying out for 9,000 years.
Adrian, let's give Adrian a chance to respond. Thanks for that, Charlie. Appreciate it. So let's go from the second point first. Difficult to quantify the effects of humans, Dr. Raftery?
Well, thanks. So thanks very much, and thanks to Charlie for some very interesting points. I think the point, Charlie's absolutely right that the climate is always changing. And if you look over, vast periods of time, there have been periods of global warming, global cooling, and so on. I think what is different about now and the most recent period is the rate at which the warming has been occurring. And that's over the period of the Industrial Revolution since about 1870, 1880. The climate has been increasing faster than at any previous point. And I think that's what really distinguishes this period from other periods. And other periods are usually attributed to, natural causes, whereas this very rapid increase over the past, hundreds some years, it does seem the speed of it needs some other explanation other than, the usual natural causes. And there seems to be wide consensus that that is, human activity, particularly industrial activity.
I was going to ask if it could be causal in the other direction, that human prosperity then produces warming instead of warming producing human prosperity.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I think that is that's the consensus conclusion of scientists, that it's the human activity that has been producing warming over the past, hundred some years of the Industrial Revolution. And that's actually related to the other point, Charlie's point about the relationship between climate and economics in China over the past 2,000 years. And I think there is, that's an interesting point. But there's a big distinction to be made between the pre-industrial period and the post-industrial period. So up to about, 1870, 1880, in what's now the developed countries, they were largely agricultural. And they had been agricultural, or the world had been agricultural for thousands of years. And during the agricultural period, the economy did go up and down with climate to quite an extent, because it was so dependent on agricultural production. So, you know, when you had good agricultural production, you had good economic situation. That has changed, and in the industrial period, which started around 1870, where what we've had is, instead of fluctuating economics, we've had a much more steady increase. There have been some fluctuations, but overall, the trend has been a strong economic increase, fueled by industry and by technical innovation. And that's the period that we're talking about, where there seems to be a general consensus among scientists that industrial production has used a lot of carbon-based fuels, which in turn have led to carbon emissions and to warming of the atmosphere.
So with the conclusion you draw here, that with a 1 in 20 chance of hitting the keeping the climate rise above 2 degrees Celsius by 2100, that really would take, it sounds like, all hands on deck agreeing that we need to do something in order to hit those targets.
Yes, agreeing, and I think there is quite a level of agreement. The real difficulty seems to be actually, you know, taking action, because it does involve, you know, tough decisions and perhaps changes that would, you know, could be inconvenient for a lot of people in some ways. So,
all right. Five authors on the study. It is called "Less Than 2 Degrees Celsius Warming by 2100 Unlikely." It's in Nature Climate Changes, July 31st issue. Adrian Raftery, professor of statistics and sociology at the University of Washington, the lead author and our guest. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.